Yeah, and now that I'm recording, just that stuff that we were talking about before, you could talk amongst yourselves, but don't put it on the gossip circuit.
No, it's fine.
Okay, so that wrong assumptions will be made. Mm-hmm. Okay, because I emphasize again, this is not any huge thing. This is just a part of practice and a part of what comes as we practice. So, like that, and I don't want it to get misunderstood out there. All right. So, he says here, I do not say that therefore we must put any violent constraint upon ourselves. No, we must serve God in a holy freedom. That is very important. You're not doing any of this because you have to. Okay, it has to be, you choose. And you're always free to choose whatever you want to choose. But it's becoming fully aware of what you're choosing. You know, to understand, to have that moment with Mother in your heart and that warmth radiating fire we were talking about, and knowing that that gets cut off when you actuate the I, when you actuate your ego, you get to choose. It's not that you have to do anything, because both of you exist. Your enlightened self and your deluded self both exist fully mature in you at the same time. So you're not giving, you're not losing your spiritual self. You're forgetting your spiritual self. So you get to make your choice. You have a holy freedom. And that's very important. Because if you feel like you're doing these things because you have to, that's the ego expressing and you identifying with that expression. You're free. And that's why you get to choose. And you've done enough discrimination and have understood clearly enough to know a choice to do that is a choice for suffering. And you can name the suffering. You know how those things make you suffer because you've thought about them. You know, you've discriminated. So you're free to do whichever one you want. And as you keep the ground level by knowing that, it makes it much easier. And when you choose, you let go immediately. Don't keep track of how many right choices you've made, because then you're building a tower. And at some point, that tower, according to your mind, will fall over. So don't keep record. Be here now, as Eckhart Tolle says. Be present. This moment is the only one that matters. It's the only one that's real. And there's no history here. This moment is clean and free. You're brand new. That's how you can let go of the story of mind. You don't have to let your reasons dictate why you act this way now. Let go. This moment is fresh, and it's new, and it is not subject to your karma. All of your karma belongs to mind, belongs to ego. You can choose, by the power of Mother and her grace, to not be engaged with it. You don't have to. Now, the mind does. The mind has to. You don't. You're free. Okay? And so by that holy freedom, relax. Put Mother back in her seat, in the heart, at the center of your very being. And if she moves you, you'll move. If she doesn't, you won't. She's not making anyone do anything because there is no anyone anywhere. There's only Mother. So you just sit in that space and watch Mother live your life.
The mind medically can let go of you, caught dementia.
Well, no. The mind has no sentience. It's not a thing. The mind is an idea, even in itself.
So they're two different things.
It is separate from you. It is not defined by you, and without you, it does not exist. So it can't do anything that you don't give it the power to do. It can break because it's a thing, you know, it can break, but you will exist fully as yourself despite it. It will affect anybody who you've placed on the other side of mind, you know. I was sharing that experience I had, it happened to me while I was here. I had that viral encephalitis, is that what it was called? That was a very odd experience for me, but it gave me a really nice insight into this idea of mind. We're very close to our mind, and that when what had happened, I don't know if I've shared the whole story, but the way that it came about is there was about a 2-day period where several things happened. And the first two or three, I managed to just ignore and just say, oh, that was weird, and not think anything. When the fourth thing happened, I knew something was up.
Did you see something?
Several things. One, I was talking over by the table there to Sam, and we were talking about going to Home Depot. And he was talking, and all of a sudden, I could hear the words, but it would not collapse into meaning. I just heard the sounds. I couldn't get any meaning from the words. And I was sitting there listening to him, and it was like, oh my God, what is that? What's going on? I was still fully there. I fully understood. I don't understand what he's saying, and that's weird. I should understand what he's saying, you know. And then it went away. And so I was like, ooh, that was weird. I wonder what that was. And I just left it at that. Then I was sitting in my chair here.
You could hear him?
Yes, I could hear him. I could hear the words, and I knew they were words. And I knew that they were familiar words, but they wouldn't collapse into meaning. You know, they just stayed words. And it was a very odd thing. And then I was sitting here in that chair, and Swami A was sitting here on his Wednesday night, and he was reading the scriptures. And I was reading too, and all of a sudden the same thing happened again. I was reading, and the words stayed on the page. They didn't mean anything to me. I was reading them just like I always do, hearing them in my mind, but they didn't mean anything to me. And I thought, oh my God, that's probably not healthy. So that was the second thing. The third thing that happened is that something happened to my eyes. I was seeing this spiral, like a prism, of prisms. And I couldn't see anything that I was looking directly at. I had to look at next to it in order to see it. And that started happening in a sustained way. Like it wasn't just a few seconds. It was like, I couldn't get it to go away. It wouldn't go away. Even when I closed my eyes, I could still see the prism spiral. When that started happening, I got up and went outside, and I sat on the stairs of the guest house and just started crying because I was terrified. I was like, this is huge. This is scary. This is something a little bit too close to me to happen. And so I came inside as soon as I composed myself, and I went straight to Sam, and I said, Sam, take me to the emergency room right now, and I'll talk to you on the way. He was like, okay. So we went down there, and it was serious. As soon as I walked in and described what was happening, they quarantined me, put me in a room all by myself, sealed off. Nobody could come in to see me without masks and gloves and all of that, and left me in there. But the experience of it was so interesting to me because the interface broke between me and this external world, right? But I didn't break. I was still fully my functional self, even though the mind wasn't working. And it gave me this notion that, wow, I bet people who have dementia, only the mind has dementia. This peace between them and the rest of the world is broken. They can't talk to you, and they can't properly hear you.
Or understand,
but they are fully present as the person you have always known, but behind, on the other side of this interface. They're still fully there. So when you talk to them like a child, even though it seems appropriate because you're talking to the mind, you know, of a person with whatever condition, they see you talking to them as a child, They can't say anything to you. They have to sit there and endure you talking to them like a child. And they know that their mind looks and sounds like a child. They know that. But they can't get, they can't reach you.
Yeah.
They're on the other side, you know.
So that knowing happens in the self? What is that knowing?
Well, it brings to light experientially the fact that you are not the mind. That your mind is an idea, it's an interface that you use to talk to the rest of your ideas. to discuss your ideas with the rest of your ideas.
How long did that last?
That lasted 5 days, I guess. They had me on so many incredibly powerful drugs. I had 6 different IV bags going into me. They had like some antivirals going in because they were trying to find it. They couldn't find it. So I was going to so many tests. There were just so many tests. They did 2 spinal taps. They were doing blood tests like every 2 or 3 hours. You know, they were sampling everything.
Did you have a headache?
No, it was funny because I was in the hospital for like 5 days for that. And I had no physical ailment, no physical discomfort, nothing at all. I just was feeling like, well, I'm in the hospital, why am I in the hospital? You know, but knowing that my mind wasn't working. But it cleared up relatively quickly. But they finally found it on the second spinal tap. They didn't find the virus itself, but they found the antibodies or indicators, I don't know, of its presence. And that's when they knew what it was. And they were like, well, this will have to get better of its own accord, but we'll put in the antivirals to kind of help it along. But that's all, by the way. The important thing is to know experientially your mind is not who you are. And now when I see people that have Alzheimer's or have, you know, dementia, and they're acting all crazy, I ignore that. And I talk to them as I assume they are on the other side, you know. It's like...
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if it's because of my practice as a Vedantist that when it happened, I distinctly saw the separation. You know, maybe if I had not done any of that practice and didn't know philosophically that it was separate from me, I may have believed myself to be demented, or I may have believed myself to be compromised, I don't know. So I don't know to what degree that somebody suffering from that is actually able to separate themselves out from it on the other side. But nonetheless, I know the possibility is there for them to exist as they have always existed. They're just going to have a broken interface, and they're going to be a little bit, if they see the outside world as real, they'll feel isolated. But otherwise, you're in a wonderful place with Mother, because now the rest of the world can't get through to you, and you can't get through to them, so you can just let it go.
So was that the fluid of the brain?
Well, there was a virus in that thing, and it had. They said that it had infected the fluids around the brain, and in particular, the area of infection was around my optical nerves, which is why I was getting those weird spirals. So, like that. But this notion—it's a wonderful. It was a wonderful thing to realize. You know, to see it in the mind sense. I had already gotten that sense when my leg broke, feeling that separation. The body is broken. I'm still completely myself. The body is broken. And what a weird thing that was. Like, my body was never something that could break before. I'd never really seen it as an object, you know, that could actually be dropped and broken. When in fact, obviously, that's what it is, but you don't think about it that way. You know, this is me, this isn't a body. Piece of material that can break. But when you sit there and you snap your leg in half and you still realize that you're fully yourself but the leg is broken, you get that understanding. I'm not the body. God, the body breaks. I don't break. I don't have parts. You know? And now that goes more subtle. The mind can break, but I don't break. You know, I'm fully the self still in that. So he's talking here, you know, that none of this is a doing, and that's what he means here by any violent constraint upon ourselves. You're not doing any of this. you're recognizing a reality, or a reality is being recognized. See why the words ruin everything, because words belong to this realm, right? So we can't. The mind is always broken, in a sense. The mind is always limiting. You know, that's that thing. That's what I learned with that experience with Moksha Prana. In the sense that we have never been spoken to, we've never been touched. That's why no amount of hugging is ever enough. That's why even in the most intimate relationships, you still can't touch your lover to the extent you want to touch your lover, and you cannot be touched by your lover to the extent that you want to be touched by your lover. It's like, because it isn't you, you're working through a very clunky apparatus to try and manifest an infinite idea, an infinite experience, an infinite being, and you're locked into this clunky thing that can't express anything infinite, you know, that can't express anything immortal. And so that's the frustration that we're born into, and that's why all of the sages say, renounce, 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 stop trying, it's not going to work. No matter what you do with this body in this world, you're never going to be able to do it, because they can't touch you and you can't touch them, and as soon as anything happens, it's finished, and you're left with nothing again but an impression, a memory, and all that memory does is create hunger, because it becomes a symbol of what you were trying to accomplish, and symbols cannot feed you. But your direct experience, your realization, the reason it will change everything about you is because it will be so vivid and so now and so immediate that you will suddenly understand what the problem has been through your whole existence as a body-mind. I've never been talked to. I've never been hugged. I've never had anybody touch me, because you can't touch me through a material thing. You can't hug me with a symbol. You can't feed me with a symbol. You can't love me with a symbol. And as many symbols as I try and hand to you in words, I can't communicate with you. Because all I can do is give you a symbol, and you have your own meanings for that symbol that you will project on them. So communication is impossible at this level, which is why we have poetry, and why we have all these arts and scriptures, and all these stories and parables and descriptions and examples. It's because the sages are living in a space that they can't do anything but give us symbols for. And since we don't have any of the experience or any of the things to project onto those symbols, that's our ignorance. That's our ignorance. You know, anyway, all of that. We must serve God in a holy freedom. We must do our business faithfully. So you have to stay established in it. Stay established. Take that mantra, never let go. The mantra is God. It is the presence of the beloved. Don't see it as a word. Don't see it as a thing. It is the divine. It is infinite love. It is infinite being. It is infinite intelligence. It's infinite existence. Revere that word when it sounds in your mind. Revere it, because it's an indicator of the presence.
It helps to erase the mind.
It is the beloved. It helps to let go of mind. Yeah, it helps to let go, because the mind, you know, in the state that we're in, we really feel like we have to do something. And so clinging to mother is what we do. And in time, even that becomes apparent as a symbol, becomes as an unnecessary thing, because you are the very thing you're seeking. We must do our business faithfully. So you just keep, you know, like I said, that ego, that identity is constantly tendrils from every side, just tendrils. And it's constantly trying to creep in. You sit there, you know, the fun one that really annoyed me and humored me a great deal was trying that Buddhist practice of watching the mind and just letting everything pass in there. And it takes a while, but after you've been doing it for a few minutes, you may get a split second or two where you're actually not attaching to anything. You're actually just letting it pass. And bliss manifests, because bliss is always there. And as soon as you stop distracting yourself with me and mine in the thought world, that bliss becomes obvious. But the first thing that happens as soon as that bliss shows up is you don't let that just go. You immediately, I'm blissful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you've attached your eye to this blissful feeling, and suddenly it's gone.
Yeah.
And then you're in a worse state because you think you've lost something. You don't realize that you've just been distracted from it. You think you've lost it. So what do? You go looking for it. And what do you use to look for it?
Mind.
Your ego. What is blocking you from experiencing it? Your ego. Do you see the terrible state we get ourselves into? What you have to do is stop. Stop. It came because the distraction stopped and you could see it. Mm-hmm. The great Swami at our dinner table in San Francisco one time said, I wish I remembered who it was. He was very excitedly sharing at the table. He says, you know, you think that your desires bring you bliss. The fulfillment of your desires bring you bliss.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you think that because every time you go and fulfill one of your desires, immediately after you fulfilled it, you feel so happy and contented. And you associate that with having filled your desire. He said, that's a lie. He said, what happened is that you fulfilled your desire and for a moment you were without desire. And the bliss that is naturally yours became apparent. But then desire will creep in again almost immediately and block off that existing bliss, and you'll be convinced that you have to go do, eat, see, taste, touch, smell something to regain that enjoyment. And that belief itself is what is blocking the bliss which is ever present in you, always with you. And so it's a game of cat and mouse, which is played completely on a lie. It's just not true. You are always blissful. Unfortunately, you're almost always distracted. So that's what he's telling us here. We must do our business faithfully, without trouble or disquiet. Why? Because trouble or disquiet is the first indicator that you are moving into ego space. Any sign of disquiet or trouble is you moving into ego space. So that's why you have to do this without either of those. Do not be discontent with your meditation, because it is your discontent with your meditation that is destroying your meditation. Right? Recalling our mind to God mildly and with tranquility. Why? Because we want as little ego as possible, but it takes a source, it takes a feather's amount of ego to put the eye back on the beloved, to put the eye back on Mother, on the symbol of your highest ideal. And you do it mildly. Why? Because if you do it intensely, that's strong ego.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want as little as possible. You want a few grams of salt in your oatmeal. Don't attack it with the whole jar.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you want to see. Oof, ego. Oof. As often as we find it wandering from him. So this is continual. And in fact, it's not continual. Only this moment matters. There is no continual when you talk about this moment. You have only one requirement. You don't have to think about God the rest of your life. You have to think about God this moment. That's all. You don't have to renounce all of your favorite things for the rest of your life. Only this moment. Don't let the mind make big things out of small things. You're not going to have to be on nothing is for the rest of your life. Everything is only in this moment. So in this moment, you don't have to work for a realization. Assume you realized in this moment. Assume that God alone exists. Assume that thou art that. And let the bliss manifest. Recognize it. That's why it's realization. It's not. It's not a. It's not an accomplishment. It's not something you're doing or are done or something you've built or the result of some practice. It's not. That's what they say, that your realization is the only effect that has no cause. That's it. It's the only effect that has no cause. A brilliant trick for our puzzle. We were genius when we threw ourselves into it. All right, he says something equally important here. It is, however, necessary to put our whole trust in God. Why? Because if your whole trust is in God, none of it's in you, the ego self. If all of your trust is in the beloved, there's no trust in you as the doer. There's no idea that I'm going to get there because I love God. I'm going to get there because I'm doing great practice. I'm going to get there because I'm a monk. I'm going to get there because I'm not a monk. I'm going to get there because... None of that. Put your whole trust in God. Not in a good meditation, not in a perpetual practice, not in the length and time and effort and strenuous activities of realization that you're manifesting and trying to earn. None of it. None of it. When you go sit in the shrine, none of your trust is in what you're doing or what you're about to do. All of it is with the beloved. I'm here, Mother. Nothing else is set. You are with Mother. Laying aside all other cares and even some particular forms of devotion, though very good in themselves, yet such as one often engages in unreasonably because these devotions are only means to attain to the end. So we just don't get caught up in any of it. Have no ideation about your experience. Have no analysis about your experience. Have no judgment about your experience. Keep your full attention on Mother. Your full trust on the divinity within you. The repeating name of your beloved. Over and over. Bringing your mind back again and again and again. Nothing else matters. And it's not the keeping your mind on God that matters. It's God that matters. And when your mind, when you know that, when you recognize that, when the mind begins to recognize that, the mind will do what matters. Pure mind and Atman are the same thing. Pure mind and Brahman are the same thing. And a pure mind is a mind fully trusting in God, fully absorbed in the presence of the Beloved, reserving nothing but the observer for itself. So when by this exercise of the presence of God, we are with Him who is our end, it is then useless to return to the means. Okay, once...
What's the means?
The means, the meditation, the practice, the scripture reading, the doership. You know, the doership is what is the lie. You didn't do anything to experience that bliss, and that's why you experienced it. So stop thinking that you have to do something when it disappears in order to make a return. That's the trick. It disappeared because somehow you took ownership. You took responsibility. You took doership, and because of that, it disappeared. You know that story of, is it Krishna or Rama?
Yeah, Krishna's.
When his disciple called out because he accidentally stepped on some washerman's clothing or something, and the guy who was chasing him, and he said, I have to go help him, and then he came back immediately, and either Sita or Radha or whatever beautiful woman was with him tells him, oh, why are you back so soon? He said, oh, I was going to help him, but then he picked up a brick, you know, to help himself. That's indicative of exactly what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That is the story, that's the symbol that sage gave to us to say exactly this. As soon as you take up doership, God is elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's nothing that you need to do to enjoy your beloved. Your beloved is, and you are as intimate as you can ever possibly be. All you need to do, stop being distracted by the sense of doership.
Yeah, that almost sounds like a silly story, but actually it's so real.
Absolutely, you can. Yeah, we experience it again and again. All of those stories, the salt, all of the stories we are currently experiencing at this very moment.
Yeah.
If we had the eyes of the sage, we could pick out all the stories. We could watch the mind trying each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the benefit of knowing them, is you start to recognize them. Like, ooh, oh, that one won't work.
Sometimes in hindsight, at least we see.
Yeah. Well, hindsight, yeah. That's a useless thing too.
That's the problem.
Hindsight doesn't exist. It's an idea. Yeah, there is no past. There is no story. There's only this moment. Only this moment. Let go of anything that isn't present. The changing means nothing. So when by this exercise of the presence of God, we are with Him who is our end, it is then useless to return to the means. But we may continue with Him our commerce of love, persevering in His holy presence, one while by an act of praise, of adoration, or of desire, one while by an act of resignation or thanksgiving, and in all the ways which our spirit can invent. So He's giving you little tools for limiting your distraction, which seems contradictory and is contradictory, but it will bring you close enough to the precipice to fall off. So even what he's saying here is a little bit of a lie, you know, a little bit of an untruth in it, that it's none of these things that you're, quote, doing that are actually making it happen, but they're more subtle ideas, and they've got enough vidya in them that they're going to bring you close enough to the precipice that you'll fall off. And once you fall off, it's all yours. It's all yours. So, by any of these means, so we may continue in the commerce of our love, you know, the give and take, offering your sacrifice, offering your renunciations, offering your good behaviors, your virtuous living, these things, this is your commerce of love, things that you're sacrificing and offering to the beloved, persevering in His holy presence, keeping the name going, keeping the idea of the beloved constantly in you, in your mind, coloring everything that you look at by that. So you can do that by an act of praise. You know, how beautiful that flower is, Thakur, how lovely you've made it. Oh, Mother, how wonderfully dressed you are today. You look beautiful in that form. You know, oh, Thakur, you look great in that outfit. You know, you just constantly by praising God, seeing Him in all things. Whether or not you're actually seeing it, it doesn't matter. You will. Just keep purifying the mind by naming Him in everything. You know? So by an act of praise, adoration, or of desire, oh God, I want you so bad. Did you feel that lust I just had, Mother? That was for you. I got confused. I want you that badly. You know? Did you see my longing when I said goodbye to my son to send him off to college? Mother, I made a mistake. That's how badly I want you. Did you feel that? Can you hear that prayer, Mother? This is how I want you. This is my desire for you. By adoration or desire, one while by an act of resignation or thanksgiving, resignation, renunciation, giving up, letting go of those things, or thanksgiving. Thakur, thank you for the pizza.
I figured that pizza was going to show up soon.
Naturally. Thank you for all these beautiful things. I see you in all of them, and what a wonder it is. My mother reminded you of you, and I felt great love for her. My son reminded me of you, and I felt great love for you. You know, my favorite food reminded me of you, and I'm grateful for you. So it's by putting God into all these things, recognizing them as they are. And in all of the other ways your spirit can invent. So he's giving you full license. Make your practice your own. Make your practice your own. Come up with ways of constantly remembering the truth that you are in bliss, that you are pure, that you are lovely, that you are immortal, that you are full and whole and need nothing, that nothing you could add to yourself would give you more than you already have. And go forward.
What are tears about?
Tears. Confusion. No, they happen. They are a symbol of whatever's happening inside. They can happen in and of themselves. They're meaningless because they can mean anything. They can mean great joy. They can mean great sadness. They can mean great inspiration. They can mean great isolation.
Are they cleansing?
No. They're nothing. They're an expression. They're not a doing. They're an expression of an inner reality. They don't do anything in and of itself. If you are being cleansed, it's not because of the tears, but because what is causing the tears is a cleansing thing. Great, great inspiration, great love for the beloved, great recognition of a gift. Those tears are signs or symbols of cleansing, but are not the thing that's cleansing in and of itself. And it's like that with everything in this world. Nothing in this world has any particular meaning. They're all symbols for what is in you. So if you're in a good mood, the world seems bright and happy. If you're lonely, the world seems isolating and dark. If you're proud of yourself, then you have optimism and hope for tomorrow. If you're disappointed in yourself, it seems dark and useless. The world has no meaning. It's only a symbol of your inner state. And your inner state is your own imagination. However you've arranged your thoughts and thinkings, whatever attachments you've made from things that you think have happened, and the meanings that you've assigned to them. But all of it is story. And like any story, you can put the book down. You're not beholden to it.
There's some poem that it's said, or I've heard it said, at a memorial service, and it begins, "Do not weep for me, I am not here." Do you know, have you ever heard that one?
No. I like the idea, but of course it's got a lot of story in it too. Because in fact he is there, and he's the one weeping for his own loss.
Really?
Yes, you are that. You, before mind, before ego, before body, are me, before body, before ego. There's only one here. Only one here, just like a dream. Only one here. It's our identity with this point in perspective that creates a separation. But before mind, if we were all, as egos, able to physically turn around in our mind and look inward together, we would all see each other.
Isn't that what namaste means?
Mm-hmm.
When I'm in that place, and you're in that place, there's only...
Yes, that's what that means. That's what this whole universe means. This universe is scripture. And when seen with a pure mind, the scriptures are heard, seen, tasted, felt. This world...
Swamiji, if tears is a sign of an emotion, then a person who has understood or understanding Vedanta should not come. If it is a...
And so maybe they didn't... No, that's not true. Look at Thakur. He wept. Jesus wept. The shortest verse in the Bible is he wept. Jesus wept. No, they can choose at what perspective they will stand to experience the dream. They can step into it, just like I said earlier, that if you step into ego, then you are in the body, and you are subject to it. If you set the ego aside, the body is in you, and you are no longer subject to it. Every other body is also in you. All experience is in you. All isness is in you. So it's not that they should not or would not or could not. It's that they can fully decide to or not to.
Yeah.
They can touch it with the sense of I or not touch it with the sense of I. For them, it's fully within their control. For us, it's not really in our control at this point. We believe it and are ignorant to the extent that we can't withdraw. That's what dispassion is about. You know, dispassion, detachment. Because, you know, one thing Vivekananda said that was very important to me, very interesting to me, is the reason that we are practicing our detachment all the time is not because we shouldn't be attached to things. It's because we're good at being attached. We're lousy at being detached. And we have to come to a state where our power of attachment is equivalent to our power of detachment. So that at will, we can sit next to a person who is suffering and fully understand and know their pain because we are them, and we can weep as a symbol to them that we understand in their state of ignorance and be with them. And at the same time, we can get up, walk out of the room, and be utterly free, knowing that that was a dream, that it's unreal.
That sounds difficult.
Very, but we see it in the Master, and he describes it quite well, in that one of his disciples dies. You know, one of the young boys dies. Purna dies, and Thakur says, you know, at the time that he was told, he understood that it was just the pillowcase had been pulled off. Nothing more than that. He felt no loss, no anything. He saw what was really going on. The pillowcase was removed. But he says, oh, the next day, I felt as if my heart had been wrung out like a towel.
Aksha. Brother's son.
You see what a sponge I am. So I just do mush in my head.
That's okay.
I know the stories, I just don't know any of the names or particulars. But that's a description of what a seer is able to do. He can have both experiences and be independent of either.
Yeah. But not she.
She also. But at that point, there is no he and she. He is part of the experience. So. Yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
Yes, well, before body, what are you going to identify with? You know, in a body, we identify with genitals. As weird as that is, as odd as that is, it's nice to say it out loud because it sounds as funny as it is. You know, when in a body, we identify with this. It has nothing more to do with us than just simply our identifying with it. We weren't always this way. You may have been a cow, you may have been a man, you may have been a hero, you may have been a beggar. You've been all of these things. Just currently you're this one. That's kind of my theory about this transgender, lesbian, gay thing, is that, you know, and this, I'm not saying this as truth. This is just my own meanderings in my mind trying to understand a phenomena. That a gay man or a gay woman, maybe in their previous life, had been the other sex and had been deeply attached to being that other sex, and now they're born as a different sex, but they can't identify with it. They're still sort of too. They brought the memory with them. They brought the idea with them. They brought the effect with them, and so now they're having to work that out. You know, like, oh God, what does this mean? I'm born into a body that's not my sex. I'm a woman because I was. I've been a woman for 3,000 years, and now suddenly I'm having my first birth as a male, you know? So the attractions manifest toward males, or toward women, or the opposite, or whatever, you know? Transgender, that whole dysphoria, gender dysphoria. You've come into a body that doesn't match your idea of self, which is not experience. You have these memories and identities.
It's interesting how young the children are when they realize it.
Yeah. Well, it's not that they realize it. Something isn't like everybody else. That's the first experience. Like, whoa, I'm not reacting to that the same way everybody else is reacting to that. What's going on with me? What's happening with me? You know? And then you begin the investigation. What am I attracted to? Why am I attracted to that? What does this mean about me? Why can't I be like that? You know? And so all of that starts going on. Anyway, all of that. It's 12, oh my gosh, it's 12:30.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to keep you over time. Hope you're not late for your next class.